This is Rabbi G, and welcome to Harvard God and Gen Z. The goal of this podcast is to discuss life's big questions with some of America's brightest young minds. We will discuss Harvard's continued sway on the imagination as the peak of success. We will discuss how to get there and what it is like when you do. We will then shift to discuss if and in what ways meaning and God are relevant features of Gen Z. What better place than Harvard for discussing these issues with the thought leaders of tomorrow?
Okay, welcome, Aaron Fogelson. It's an honor to have you here, the first guest here on our new podcast, Harvard God and Gen Z. And it's the goal here is to pick your mind and hear what is on the minds of this generation. Is spirituality still important? Is it still relevant? Aaron is a Harvard All-Star, and we're going to start off a little bit with trying to understand where does Aaron come from. Aaron, tell us who you are. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the city of Chicago. I love it here. It's an amazing place. I feel very blessed to be someone from the Midwest and from Chicago to go to Harvard. Not many of us who go that route, but it's been a great journey. And anything else? Any other background? I don't have.
Yeah. Do you come from an academic family?
Sort of, kind of. My parents aren't academics. They're both, working parents. My brothers are both very academic. My mother raised us, hitting the books, making sure we were always studying, making sure we were always doing our homework. So my oldest brother went to Harvard.
How did she do that? Was education really pushed? Was it an intense environment or?
Yeah, it was a little bit intense. I'd say it was intense in a way that was more aspirational, I guess, than intense. It was like she presented to us the benefits of education rather than pushed us towards it. It was less of a push.
And how did she do that effectively without you rebelling?
Oh, that's a good question. One thing that I think was really good is all of our desks in our house growing up were all in the same room, me and both of my brothers. So there was sort of this team, but also a little bit competitive element of learning and education that was very fun. And we would take breaks at the same time and work at the same time. So I think that team element was really helpful having my brothers there. But
smart.
Also, I think my mom was a really hard worker and my dad also both very hard workers. And just watching people who you admire work really hard, I think gives you a good work ethic. And
sure.
I think the big...
Did you get tutors or did you have special help or it was just
competitive? Yeah, we had tutors, which is really very helpful. If there was ever a time when we were struggling or where we were above and beyond and needed a little additional stuff, we would definitely get help. And then also we were very blessed to have extracurricular activities that were really helpful. I did math team and science Olympiad and...
Those were your choices or that was something your mother or your parents pushed?
Again, it was less of a push and more of a pull. It was look at all these great opportunities. I never felt pushed because it didn't feel like it was forced or unnatural. It felt why wouldn't I do more activities? We were all very social, me and my brothers.
Sure.
And, when you have an opportunity to be home doing homework or be home doing nothing versus going out and doing an extracurricular with friends, the extracurriculars start to seem really great. And I don't know. I think we were all very attracted to doing more than,
And at what point did you see Harvard as the natural destination or aspirational destination? I mean, were you standing out already and everyone said, oh, you should go to Harvard or?
I think it was mostly the brother thing. I mean, I think that having a sibling or a family member at one of those institutions is very helpful for those type of aspirations. My brother Mitch, my middle brother, also went to University of Pennsylvania, which is another Ivy League school. So, I was very blessed to have two brothers who sort of trailblazed the road ahead of me. And then, my high school was a magnet school. So it was a lot of the top students from throughout Chicago. So a lot of people were headed towards top, universities. So yeah, it felt like the natural path sort of, I'd say senior year. So not really that soon, but after I finished college and I had a lot of, stuff on the resume and, the grades and my brother and all these other things, it sort of became an option. I don't think anyone ever thinks it's a surefire thing.
Sure.
But it was really lovely to get in. I mean, definitely. Made,
tell me about that. Tell me about your reaction when you got in. Was it a highlight? Were you?
So I don't know. I guess like it was more. I guess, you know, when you have a sibling there, there's a lot of expectation. So it was more of a relief, I'd say,
okay,
than excitement. It was just like, oh, thank God. Also, like I applied early. So if you don't get in early, you have to do a whole another round of applications. So that was another relief that I didn't have to do any more applications. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's got such a big name. I think that whenever anyone hears, it's just so exciting. And I was in the library with a large amount of people around. So like I was trying to hold in the emotion, not like have a crazy reaction, but I told some close friends, and it was really nice to see other people react. And it's always very emotional. So, you know,
sure.
I cried a tear or two, but it was
okay.
You know, all very great. It was a really amazing surprise.
And if you could give advice to people out there, you know, as you know, it's not just smarts to get into that 5% that gets in. Is there anything else that made you stick out in some way that you think was crucial for you to get in?
Yeah, that's a great question. I always tell people, you know, find some silver bullets, you know, find areas of yourself that are above and beyond and really try to highlight those and focus on those and work to bring those out. So for example, for me, I was really good at math. So I did math team. And then, you know, junior year, I was like, okay, I really want to make this even bigger. So I did science Olympiad and, you know, worked on different elements, I guess, of the math and science background. And then I also did a lot of Jewish stuff. So, you know, I started by just doing my youth group, USY, Shmoozy, shout out, Chicago area, USY. And yeah, so I did that. But then I also started, I became the president of the Jewish Student Union at my high school because I was probably the most prominent Jew, most active Jew in the high school. And that also added to more in that element. So, you know, having a bunch of areas where you can, you know, put your mark on and really make a difference, I think is what a lot of these colleges are looking for. Yeah. And I would just say, do what you love. You know, if you love it, it doesn't feel like work and it'll make it so you can do a lot more and achieve at much higher levels.
But it sounds like you had a lot of passions and those passions were always there. You cultivated them. It sounds like you were very clear about what you wanted and were passionate about.
Yeah, I just really wanted to be busy. So I think being busy was really the priority. And then I sort of filled it in. You know, I also did like weird things. I was on the bowling team. I was on the golf team.
I had time for all that. That's
government. Like I did a lot of random stuff that I wouldn't say was part of my like application process. Like I'm trying to think of other ones, but I feel like I did like every organization on campus. So, you know, there was a lot of different activities that I did, but I really, you know, when you're in high school and you're working all day, it's nice to do these extracurriculars that give you an opportunity to, you know, spend time with other students and meet other people and just be around the school environment with all the resources and all the activities. It's just better than being at home doing work. Like basically I would get home, I'd eat dinner, I'd do work and I'd go to bed. So having this hour and a half at the end of school to do an extracurricular was really a treat.
So was it better to get into Harvard or to go to Harvard? What was your favorite part of being at Harvard? Is it kind of a lot of hype or once you're there, it's really an amazing experience? What was your experience like?
It's definitely a lot of hype. I mean, I'll say that it's a lot of hype, but I would say college in general is an amazing experience. So, you know, maybe other schools are just underhyped and Harvard's just overhyped and it's somewhere in the middle, but it was an amazing experience. I really loved college. I really loved my professors. I really loved just the institution and the people who really just cared about it and the history. And man, the most important thing is the people there and the people you meet. And I met just some amazing...
So the top three parts you would say are what? The
people is probably number one. The opportunities, I guess. I mean, I don't know really what you would call that, but like the brand or the opportunities, the doors it opens would probably be number two. And then number three would maybe be, I don't know. It's a good question. Maybe the extracurriculars, is that same as opportunities? Extracurriculars were great. And then the classes might be number four. And then, you know, it's all great. It's all amazing. I would say the food is probably not on that top 10 list, but everything else.
The biggest last time about Harvard was the food or were there other hard things about it that was kind of...
No, the food is actually not that bad either. I don't mean to. The dining hall staff is amazing and the food is great. There's nothing hard. Harvard is a really friendly and supportive institution in a lot of ways. You know, I think for certain people, it's less supportive and friendly and less accommodating, but for someone like me who, you know, really naturally transitioned from high school to college, doing a lot of the same, actually, I didn't do a lot of the same activities. I switched to a lot of new activities, but just doing a lot and wanting to do a lot and being very exploratory, I think it really supports that.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I'll say, I mean, Harvard is a place of a lot of rejection. I think that I often, you know, maybe in my mind with the rosy-colored glasses, I'd look back on that without focusing on it. But, you know, I was rejected from the first 12 organizations I tried out for.
Wow. So getting to Harvard is not the only
Exactly.
Hurdle.
Once you get there, you think you're done. You know, a lot of us, especially like coming from my background, you think you get to Harvard and you're like the king. You're like game over, right? I didn't know many people outside of my brother who went to Harvard. So I felt like, oh my God, you know, I made it. But then once you get there, you get rejected from everything. It definitely puts you down a peg. But I'm lucky. I have a very optimistic attitude. I'm pretty adaptable. And I was really willing. I mean, it drove me to a lot of organizations that ended up being amazing for me. Like, I would have never joined the radio station had I been accepted to some of those earlier organizations. And it ended up being the centerpiece of my college experience. So I think it is really a good place if you're willing to experiment, you know, ready for failure, ready to overcome failure, and ready to just keep pushing forward, because there's just so much there that even if you're like 10 tiers down from the stars, you're really, you know, still, you know, shoot for the moon, land among the stars type deal. You're still like really in the top.
So it sounds like you have an incredible attitude about just in general about life. And that really helped you get through that. What most people, I think, if rejected 12 times from Harvard, would maybe give up or get down on themselves. Or, you know, once you're in a whole crowd of other excellent people, you start to feel less excellent about yourself. Mm-hmm. So even though you were able to maintain and see it as a challenge and opportunities, when you looked around, what would you say? Are people happy and fulfilled at Harvard?
So I was actually just talking about this with my older brother, and I think it's split, basically. I think it's 50-50. I think people who, you know, find spaces that are good for them really become happy and really succeed and really thrive. And people who never find that space or, you know, get turned off by rejection or get, you know, don't have the confidence to keep trying or something like that, who never find that right group or right space for them, that can be really hard and it can be really demoralizing. And so I think a lot of people experience that. That was not my experience, but I was a peer advising fellow for freshmen. So I, you know, met with a lot of freshmen and talked with them through their struggles and their failures and their rejections. And I think a lot of people really take it hard and really struggle and need a little bit more support or need a different institution or, you know, just get unlucky. And it's really nice, you know, those peer advising fellows and all the mentors throughout the Harvard, you know, establishment, I guess, like the people who are there to support you. It's a sort of a crapshoot if you're going to get someone who's fits your energy and who knows your style and who can support you and give you advice that's appropriate. So, you know, I'm really good at helping people who have also been rejected from 100 things, but, you know, I might not be the best person to advise like a student athlete who gets injured. That might be a really hard experience that I can't have the same kind of, you know, empathy and advice and encouragement for. So I think it's a balance. I think some people have great experience, some people have hard experience. I think it's some due to circumstance, some due to attitude, but I think it's often, I think for the most part, my understanding based on my community is that people at the end of the day, when they graduate and look back on it, thought they were very blessed and very lucky to have the opportunity to go to Harvard.
Beautiful. And is it true? I know Harvard has a bit of a reputation about being snobby or arrogant. Is that true? And did you find in your experience, or actually maybe the opposite, that once you're there, you realize how many other great people there are and it's maybe humbling? How did you stay humble?
That's a good question. As to snobbiness and arrogance, I think it has that reputation. I think partially true, partially not. I think with every like stereotype, there's some little nugget of truth to it. I think that it can make you arrogant. I think that that's very real. But I don't know if it accepts a higher percentage of arrogant people. Maybe it does, but I don't think so. The people I hung around, I tried not to associate myself with people who were too pompous or elitist or anything. But there is that. I think as with every institution, you're going to find people who are overconfident and elitist and exclusionary. And I think that that totally exists at Harvard. I would say it's a 15% maybe. And then I'd say maybe a bottom 15%, you know, get really turned off by that. Whereas I think the middle, what does that mean? 70% are very warm, very welcoming, very kind, don't really care about people being elitist, are just sort of going with the flow. I think you're right. It's very humbling to meet so many other just talented, amazing people. You know, for some people it's discouraging, for some people it's humbling, for some people it's, you know, it makes them more confident because they're like, oh, if I'm in this class of people, right. I'm doing it. So, you know, I think it's all across the board how people react to being in that environment. I'd say for me, it was very, yeah, humbling. I mean, it just showed me the amount of great effort and intellect that a lot of people put in to get to the institution. And it made me, you know, just that much more excited about being there, and more feeling more blessed and grateful to be there. But as for it, you know, changing how I was behaving or acting, I think really the fellow students were really more of an inspiration than they were, you know, pushing me down or pushing me.
And beautiful. So it sounds like it's a great place if you go in with the right attitude, knowing that there might be some rejection ahead. But as long as you take every rejection as a learning experience and look for those right opportunities, then it can really be a great place to be.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that that is true about almost every place.
That's right.
I'll say Harvard probably on every little tick is like a tick above the rest. But yes, you just got to find your space and, you know, appreciate it and make the most of it.
Great. And we're going to shift a little bit now. The question is, in the modern world, in this new generation, does God ever come up into the picture? Did you grow up with God in your family? Was spirituality or meaning God, was that a big topic in your household growing up?
So I grew up in like a reform conservative Jewish community. You know, we did like basic practices. We kept like a kosher style. We lit candles on Shabbat and had people over and a nice dinner. We, you know, went to synagogue on a lot of the holidays, actually, not just the high holidays. We went to synagogue on a couple holidays. Every one of my friends was basically bar mitzvahed. I was bar mitzvahed. So I had a pretty strong Jewish upbringing, but God, I don't think was a very hefty part of it. And I guess like religious theology or philosophy was pretty absent from the picture. It was much more of a cultural thing, much more about the practices than about the purpose or the meaning or the why behind anything. And now I feel like I've gotten that in loads, you know, I've been able to find that on my own, but I definitely don't think it is.
What drove you to look for, did something drive you to look for something more, was on the way, or at what point did you realize maybe you did want something more than just a cultural experience, but you did want the theology? How did that develop?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that whenever anyone examines their behavior and what they're doing in their life, they need a why behind every how. You know, like, how am I going to get through Harvard? You need a why. You need a reason to get through it. You need, like, why am I going to, like, how am I going to, you know, finish this assignment? You need a why, like, that's going to drive you to do it. And, you know, I was doing all these Jewish practices and I knew how to do them, but I didn't know why I was doing them. So, you know, I was doing a lot of Jewish stuff without any sort of reasoning. So when I examined that behavior and, you know, examined my actions, which demonstrated that I was really valuing this Jewish element of my life, I really wanted to look why I was valuing it and what was the actual meaning behind it. And, you know, originally when I did that, I assumed it was going to turn up that there's no why, that it's all hocus pocus, it's all nonsense, that, you know, I was, you know, looking behind the curtain and going to see, you know, nothing there. But really what I found was a really deep and intense theology and philosophy that reminded me a lot. I was a philosophy concentrator at Harvard, and it reminded me a lot of the philosophy I learned from all the great philosophers, even, you know, like Plato, Socrates, even Heidegger, who's a Nazi, you know, all Nietzsche, like all of these people seem to take a lot of elements from what's monotheistic, Old Testament practices and philosophy and morality. And I don't think they really give credit, but when you really read those texts, you see a lot of the underlying values of our current society. And that's pretty impressive given the fact that it was 6,000 years ago and seems to have been written in a period void of the modern values, liberal values.
Right.
And it found those out of a void and very early on and passed them down in a way that was a common law tradition that, you know, allowed for updating and modernizing and adding and reevaluating, but in a way that was, you know, a lot more respectful, I guess, of the origin and of the Constitution. And it reminded me a lot of the philosophies and the institutions that I appreciate that are, you know, rooted in core values that they, you know, hold very dear, and then try to, you know, modify the practices and the values as time goes on to, you know, meet the moment. And, you know, maybe it's a little slower, I guess, than probably, you know, general morality or general philosophy. But I think that slowness has been part of, you know, the survival of the Jewish people. It's been part of the reason that, you know, we don't lose our way, is that, you know, we do hold fast to, you know, what the generations before us have done. And I think it's a delicate balance of, you know, the inherent conservativeness of a religion and the desire to be, you know, a modern, you know, liberal member of society who, you know, appreciates progress and inclusivity and a lot of the new moral norms. It's a tough balance, but it's something that I think Jews have done a great job toiling with over the last 6,000 years. And I think throwing away that essence, that constitution, those underlying values would be a disservice to not only oneself, but to the whole history of the Jewish people and the current community of Jewish people.
Totally hear that. And you mentioned something interesting, that you were living in a how-to world and eventually you started asking why. Do you believe everyone at their core needs an answer to why, or people just don't look, or when they do look, they just don't find anything, or some people just don't even need to ask the question, just kind of, yeah, whatever.
It's a good
question. Or do you think everyone kind of needs a why?
Yeah, so I think it was Nietzsche, but I'm not sure, that said, if you have a good why, it can get you through any how. And I think that that's exactly right. It's, you know, there are things in life that are very hard to get through. Everyone goes through sickness, familial death, trauma, tragedy, horrors, you know, that's just the circle of life. And there's always going to be, you know, difficulties, you know, even in little things, even in, you know, relationships and friendships and in getting through a day. I mean, there are things that it's hard to rationalize how to get from point A to point B, how to put one foot in front of the other. And that why, if it's strong and steady and confident and clear, it makes it a lot easier to get through those hows. And, you know, there are levels to hows, right? Like, there's how do I get up and make sure I put my clothes on in the morning? But then there's how do I work for an 8-hour day? And how do I make sure that I'm being a good role model? And how do I make sure I'm taking care of my family? And how do I make sure that I'm, you know, being appreciative? And how do I make sure that I'm being grateful? And all of those things, it's like, why do any of those things if there's so much work? But that why allows you, if your why is strong, it allows you to do many more hows, right? It allows you to expand on your hows. I explained it to my brother like this, and I think this is probably, you know, sort of the easiest way to think of it. You know, people seem to just be, and in most places, you see them as they're walking through the forest in some sense. And you don't really see their point A and their point B. You don't really see the landscape of the forest, and you don't really see, you know, any of that stuff. So for an individual, oftentimes we don't even see it for ourselves. We just see our actions, and we're not focused on, you know, who am I, where am I going, and what is this landscape that I'm in? And I think once you establish that, you know, what is my landscape of value is how I describe it. You know, do I value family? Do I value work? Do I value education? Do I value religion? Do I value, you know, giving? Do I value consuming? You know, how you value things is going to end up correlating to how you behave and how you make decisions that have, you know, difficult value tensions, right? You know, when you walk by a homeless person and they ask you for money, you know, you'd think maybe just give them all the money in your wallet every single time, right? But you have to value yourself and your own consumption. And every moment in life is that difficult value choice between, you know, what do I keep for myself? What do I give to others? How do I spend my time? You know, and that is a very hard thing to control. So first you need to get your map of the forest by building up your value map. And then you say, where am I? How am I actually behaving currently? So how am I acting upon this current value map? And then where do I want to get? How do I want to be implementing my values at point B? And so then you navigate your way through the forest trying to make decisions that get yourself from this value person to this value person. And it's a slow, difficult process. And often the forest isn't exactly as you calculated it, right? Maybe you had misvalued things, or you misassociated or misunderstood where the trees were, and you bump into a tree, and then you got to say, okay, I got to up my value on family and lower my value on work because, you know, I'm not taking care of my parents enough, or I'm not there mm-hmm. for my grandparents. I'm not calling I used to not call my grandparents, but maybe once a month for like 2 minutes. I try to call them weekly now. That was,
Where did that change come from?
All that's happening. You know, you see all the stuff that's going on and it reminds you the fragility of life and what is really important. And that helps you reevaluate. So, you know, you got to just keep on constantly reevaluating your values and how that's being acted out and where you're going and who you are at the moment. And that is something I don't think many people do, but religion gives you.
And what's the reason why you think most people don't do it? Is it because society doesn't value this search that you're describing? People are distracted. Or do you think people want to do it and just don't have the tools? What do you think is the biggest block?
I think it's a combination of things. Mm-hmm. I think that everyone inherently wants to do it. I think that most people are not given the framework or the guidance or the support needed to do it. I mean, it seems easy, right? What do I value? But it's actually really, really hard to calculate those things and to see where you're at in terms of those values, right? Like, for example, like I know that I value, you know, giving a lot more than I'm probably acting upon that. And I value, you know, treating, like being more grateful than I'm acting. Like sometimes I'm not grateful. Sometimes I talk behind people's backs, you know, I'm not acting out my exact values. So that is a hard thing to come to recognize, right? It's hard to come and say, you know, I am not living up to actually what I believe. Right. I am not acting upon my own beliefs. I am not acting as who I want to be. That's a hard first step to get to. And, you know, then taking that's one step is just recognizing that you are not your full values. Then seeing how you can become more like that value is also hard, right? Seeing what's the path to getting me from this point where I'm, you know, a little bit lazy, where I procrastinate, where I do this, to the person who's, you know, on top of things, who's taking care of his family, who's taking on responsibility for the people around him, who's working hard. That path is a hard path to draw also. And then the hardest part, after you finally found the values and I've found the path and done all of that, then you have the very difficult thing of walking the path, because the path is not a very easy path to walk. The much easier path is the nihilistic or hedonistic path of, you know, submission, I guess. I guess there's sort of two. There's nihilism and hedonism, which is basically acting upon your desire, your base desires, your animalistic desires, just purely physical, just act. You don't think, you're not conscious. And then there's the other thing where it's postmodernism, where you think, oh, all of the things are true. Like every path is worthy of doing. And so you just walk down a random path and you don't think about it. And both of those, I think, are easy pitfalls to fall into, because the middle way, as they say in Buddhism, or, you know, the middle line, that path of not every path is equal, but not no path is good. This path of, you know, this is my path. Finding your own path and walking on that is a very, very difficult process, and then a very difficult thing to act out. And it forces you to tell yourself, I am not good enough. And I can, but it also, then also the other flip of that is I can get better. And so I think that both of those things are hard for people to come to terms with, because getting better is hard. It takes a long time and it's not easy to recognize personal improvement.
And in your estimation, do you believe that, you're mentioning a path and whatnot, do you believe that this, you're saying that there is a path or somewhat of a path? Is that possible without the concept of a divine being behind this world, or is a divine being a necessary step towards trying to better yourself and find a path that you're saying is maybe slightly more objective or has some real value?
Yeah, so I believe that normativity, that there is some objectiveness in the world, that there is some true value, that let's say just even the most basic claim that life is better than death, or that, you know, love is better than hate, you know, those basic claims I think are predicated on a God, me personally. Now, I don't think that everyone needs to start with God to get to those claims. I think a lot of people take those claims as axiomatic. They believe those claims without needing to believe in the God first. But to me, if you go down to the core of those claims, the only way to hold those claims in place is to say, okay, a God exists, or something, some greater force exists, something beyond the world exists that dictates value or creates value or rules over value. Otherwise, there would be no reason to say that life is better than death. It'd be very easy to argue that death is better than life in a world where value is not objective and extra worldly created. So to me, I think, yes. Do I think everyone needs to believe in a God or a God in particular or a particular type of God? No, I think it's really good for people to believe that the world was created. I think it's really good for the people to believe that humans are endowed with an element of that creator, that all humans, including oneself and others, I think that without those basic core claims, a lot of the, you know, modern Western liberal axioms would fall apart. Now, again, is everyone thinking about all this and gonna, you know, be like, oh my God, normativity can't work without, you know, a divine being or an extra worldly creator, an infinite force, whatever.
Right.
I don't think everyone's going to be like that. But for me personally, as someone who tried to dig into these claims and try to find, you know, a sense of, you know, truth, it really, for me, needed it. It was predicated on, if I wanted free will, if I wanted value, if I wanted, you know, the opportunity for growth, all of those things were predicated on an axiom of God.
Now, you mentioned all the difficulty in this journey, difficulty to think about it, to enact it, to find it. It seems almost such a steep hill to climb. You're obviously a person that has shown in his life that nothing stops him. 12 rejections didn't stop you. It seems like
I've had very little trials and tribulations on my life. I've had a very lucky, blessed life. So I would not say I am the model of someone who's overcome or persevered. Okay. I would say I am more of the model of someone who walked down a very clear, lovely path that was guided by a lot of people. And that's why I think I am able to stand on a hill in some sense, because I was given such, you know, support and such an easy road that for me to get to this point, it was millions of miles easier than for most people. And I think that that is really the big difference. It's not that I'm a perseverant or XYZ. It's that I had such support and such.
I hear what you're saying, but generally speaking, you know, the dictum, there's no atheist in a foxhole, that usually people who are comfortable choose a comfortable path, and you were comfortable and chose an uncomfortable path. So I do hear what you're saying, but I also think the other way, that people who are uncomfortable are often most what psychologists call boundary experiences that push us to make a change. So I do hear both ways. That also someone who has gone through difficulty could also be willing to engage in this type of path.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think that that is a good point. I will say that in college, I went through what I always describe as a postmodernist and a nihilist phase. I went through both. I think that they're both easy traps to fall into. And I was, I would say, lifted out by theology and God and the religious philosophy. And I think that it's really, really, really helpful to have a religious framework and a religious language and a religious dialogue and a religious community to have these discussions to get you out of those traps. Because, you know, right, not everyone's a day-to-day philosopher, right? Not everyone is listening to philosophy podcasts or reading philosophy or any or thinking about all these things on a day-to-day basis. And religion was made basically to avoid the pitfalls of philosophy. Judaism, especially Buddhism too, a lot of good, I mean, Hinduism actually has a lot of this too, Christianity, Islam, a lot of these monotheistic and older religions that are still around have this, their very first premise is to avoid postmodernism and nihilism. It's saying good exists, bad exists, you know, we can get to the good, other people are trying to get to the good, that everyone, the world is growth oriented. Those basic core principles are necessary and very hard to find and start with and discuss and toil with without religion. I think that it's a little bit hard.
So my last question is going to be, given that religion is a bit of a dirty word today and it has a lot of connotations and a lot of backlash, how would you do it? Someone in your generation, your age, given the difficulty of the journey, given the stigma is the right word for religion, how would you articulate, and you've said some of it, obviously, the benefit of why, you just articulated the benefit of God and lifting you up on nihilism. So have a conversation with me. I'm one of your peers. What would you say to say, hey, it's worth it. It's worth the journey. It's worth getting over the stigma. It's still relevant. How would you articulate that?
Yeah, I would first, I mean, there's sort of I would give them the why before the how, right? How to become religious is much easier than why to become religious. And, you know, I saw a quote, I forgot who said it, but it was, you know, it's much more important to teach someone why God is necessary than why he exists. And mm-hmm. I think that that's right. I think that I usually tell people from my personal experience that religion and God and theology has been the biggest blessing in my life. It's turned my entire mental health, physical health, productivity, outcomes, all into a new sphere. I used to look at the world as a outlet for receiving pleasure. Now I look at it as an opportunity to become the best individual possible. And that change in outlook is world shifting. I mean, it shifts the world from the world is engulfing you and you are merely consuming it to you are part of the team involved in the creation and destruction of the universe. And, you know, that responsibility and that opportunity changes the way you look at day-to-day tasks. I mean, you told me this, and I think this is a really great thing that helped me a lot. At the top of my to-do list, I have, what do I want to accomplish in my service to God, and how can I manifest that today? And that gets me through this huge to-do list of, you know, edit my website, you know, send 19 emails, you know, check in with these 15 people, make sure that you give a compliment to 3 people on this. You know, I have all these tasks that I want to do to, you know, serve this higher force, this understanding of goodness. And I always tell people, you know, God is a dirty word. It's become a dirty word. Just replace the word God with good, right? If you just believe in goodness, infinite, extra-worldly goodness, that goodness as a thing exists, the world of forms, as Plato put it. If you believe that goodness exists and that humans are endowed with goodness and have the opportunity to bring about or diminish their goodness, I think that you are 90% of the way to a belief in God and the traditional, you know, monotheistic religious process. You know, there are pitfalls along the way, but those early axioms really get you on a good path. And then from there, you know, I really also like to tell people, because I think a lot of people find religion to be, you know, closing off, like exclusive and contracting, and it like keeps you tied into a particular way of life. And I always tell people, no, religion, especially Judaism, I'm not actually very learned on many other religions, but Judaism is very pluralistic. You know, there are 3 fathers and 4 mothers, each with different strengths and weaknesses, each who value different things in different levels, who have different journeys and different paths to growth. And that's true about every individual. You know, religion is a fence. It puts fences around things, but it does not determine your whole path. It helps you determine your path even beyond the fences. It helps you then dig the path within those fences of how you particularly should live, but not everyone has the same path. You know, I really value certain things that have me pursuing a path of law school and media and entertainment and working with the people I work with and doing the things I do on a day-to-day basis are based on my personal values within the Jewish framework. But Judaism alone is not going to paint you your full picture. It gives you the framework to look at your picture and decide for yourself and paint it yourself. I mean, at the end of the day, another great quote I love is, your choices are an opportunity to define who you are. And Judaism just gives you a framework to help make those choices, right? That's it. And I think that without that framework, you're choosing blindly and you're letting the whole point of life, which is becoming the best person you could be, slip away. And that's kind of what I would tell people. I don't know. I'd also say, talk to people, talk more about it, you know, have conversations. Don't be afraid to admit that you believe in God. I think that most people today, and even me, I really struggle to admit that I believe in God. I'm constantly made fun of for becoming more religious. I'm constantly, you know, picked on, teased, whatever you want to say. I mean, I don't care because it doesn't hurt me that much. I think it's funny, honestly. I mean, it is pretty crazy nowadays to see someone become more religious. It is very out of the norm, and I totally understand that. And, you know, it's not an easy philosophy to land on. You know, it was not my first choice. You know, it's much easier to dive into postmodernism or nihilism. They're much easier to rationalize and give the reasoning for. But at the end of the day, those things get rid of what I find to be axioms that I believe in, which is that there is good, that there is free will, that humans have the opportunity to grow, and that we are inherently good, and that we are inherently, you know, growing the world alongside God. And I think that that's changed my life, and I would hope that I could help others see the same thing. But, you know, it's not for everyone, maybe. And, you know, I think there are a lot of ways, a lot of religions and a lot of philosophies and a lot of belief systems that can help you get to a really good path for your own self. So I don't know if everyone should be any one religion. I just think that religion in general is a very good framework for discussing these, you know, metaphysical things that, you know, every generation has toiled with, and that our generation seems to have enough distractions maybe to ignore.
Aaron, thank you so much. That was incredibly insightful. It's very clear you've thought a lot about this and articulated it incredibly clearly. And we hope you can be that beacon of light that can destigmatize a lot of these issues, because I do think we can't ignore the fact that in the modern world, people are struggling. I think part of that struggle, it does have to do with this area of life that seems to be lacking, and the conversation is lacking. And hopefully you can be a beacon of light to create the conversation and steer the conversation in a positive way. So thank you so much for joining us and sharing your journey. And hopefully we'll check in again in the future to hear more about your journey. And really appreciate your time.
And thank you, because I would not be on this journey without you. You know, everyone needs support and role models and people in their life who, you know, put them on a certain path. And if it weren't for you, and if it weren't for, you know, my parents and my siblings and the other religious mentors, I mean, I had a lot of great rabbis growing up, even though they weren't necessarily focused on the same theological aspects, that allowed me to get onto this path, and that has helped me live such a blessed and fulfilling life. So I'm very appreciative to you and all those who have supported me. And it's an honor to hopefully share something that maybe will resonate with one person, and hopefully they'll share something that will resonate with another, and eventually we'll all get to a place where we're growing and working together. So that's the dream.
Wonderful. Beautiful. Thank you so much.
All right. Talk to you later.